The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in this week for John Hockenberry. On this Monday, the woman President Obama described as redefining the role of First Lady. Nancy Reagan died at the age of 94 this weekend. We'll look at her life and her influence later this hour. And we want your memories, too. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can tweet us about the First Lady at The Takeaway. Also, an extraordinary account from inside one of the most terrifying places on the planet. We'll share extracts from a series of audio diaries from Raqqa in Syria, the capital of the self-described Islamic State. But it was also a weekend of presidential primary voting for the Democrats. Senator Bernie Sanders won in Nebraska, Kansas, and Maine over the weekend, while Hillary Clinton took Louisiana. On the Republican side, Donald Trump won more narrowly than he expected in Louisiana and Kentucky. And while Senator Marco Rubio only won in Puerto Rico, Texas Senator Ted Cruz got Kansas and Maine and bolstered his claim in this chaotic mess of a GOP primary that he is the only viable GOP alternative to Donald Trump.
We're seeing Republicans coming together. We're seeing conservatives coming together. We're seeing libertarians coming together. We're seeing all of us unite and stand together.
Senator Ted Cruz now looks ahead to Tuesday with Republican contests in Mississippi, Idaho, Hawaii, and the big prize of Michigan with 59 delegates up for grabs. If the media narrative of a Cruz surge is true, he still has to confront what appears to be a huge double-digit lead for Donald Trump in Michigan. Joining me is Dimitri Sevastopoulou, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Hi, Dimitri.
Hi, Todd.
Good to have you. How do you assess the race now that Cruz has chalked up a couple of more wins over the weekend?
Well, I think that the first thing to remember is that if there's still four people in the race, and technically it's still possible that one of those four could amass the 1,237 delegates needed to get the nomination. But the reality is that the race seems to have narrowed to two people. It's Donald Trump, it's Ted Cruz. Marco Rubio and John Kasich, the Florida senator and Ohio governor, they have roles to play possibly as spoilers. We can talk a little bit about a contested convention, which they may be aiming for. But Cruz is the one who has emerged as the only one who has beaten Donald Trump in multiple states. And in the delegate count, he's now at 300. Donald Trump is only at 384. So they're actually very close.
Cruz has shown good organization on the ground, ability to get people out, especially in closed caucus situations, core Republican voters. Is it possible to know if this is also a sign of a weakening Trump at the same time or just good Cruz organization?
I think it's probably a combination of both. I mean, Cruz has shown all along, from the caucuses in Iowa, which he won, to Maine, which I think surprisingly he won over the weekend, that he's a very good organizer. He's got good grassroots operations, and he's got a relatively big war chest he can take money from. Donald Trump may have been hurt by his comments at the debate last week, where he essentially talked about the size of his penis. We don't really know how some of those things resonate with his base. Some signs are that late deciding voters have tended to go for candidates other than Trump, which may suggest that he's weakening a little bit. But Trump has shown at every stage of this race since he jumped in June last year that every time he does something that people think is going to backfire, he gains strength from it. So I think we don't know the answer yet.
Right. And it is very hard to project the rest of the delegate math, as you said. But we got to look forward to Florida and Ohio, both on March 15th, next Tuesday. Florida has been voting for nearly a week already. They have early voting there. That should be a huge advantage for Donald Trump. And if Trump wins both in Florida and in Ohio, it may actually be over for Ted Cruz, just in terms of delegate math.
I think it'll be extremely difficult. I mean, first of all, if Florida is won by Trump, then Rubio will almost certainly get out of the race. John Kasich has said that if he can't win his own state, that there's no point staying in. So you would then be down to a two-horse race. As you say, the delegate math would overwhelmingly favor Donald Trump. And the other thing to remember is Ted Cruz's natural constituency tends to be in the South, where there's a heavier proportion of evangelical voters. Once you get into the Midwestern states and some of the other parts of the country, California later on in the process, he doesn't have as much natural support support. Now, it's possible that if he has momentum and he's beating Trump in other places, people will rally behind him, particularly if it's a two-person race. You know, what Marco Rubio likes to say, Ted Cruz's best days are behind him and mine are ahead of me. There's an element of truth to that, but I think the gap is pretty big right now.
You mentioned the contested convention, and there are so many details and possibilities there that we can't game all of them out. But it seems like an extremely risky scenario, Dimitri. Of course, the party wants to prevent Donald Trump from taking the nomination. But if they do it with ballot chicanery and sort of floor convention deals, they're going to alienate millions of people who came out for Trump, and that could damage the party irrevocably.
It could, but the Republican Party right now is caught between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, there are many people who don't like Donald Trump, even though he's the one who's winning most of the contests among the electorate. The party thinks that he cannot win the general election because of some of his comments that would alienate women and various minorities. On the other hand, the establishment hate Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz does not have a single member of the Senate where he works endorsing him. So he's loathed by the Republican establishment. So they've got to decide, well, which is the worst of two evils? A contested convention allows possibly someone else to jump into the fray. But as you say, the danger there is all of the Trump voters and possibly some of the Cruz voters then decide to stay home in November and hand the election to the whoever the Democratic candidate is.
Decide that their votes don't matter because the party is still controlling things. And the Ted Cruz scenario here, Dimitri, before I let you go, you know, even if Cruz can win outright, has he shown any of the sort of broad appeal that you need to finally get to the White House?
No, I don't think he has. And that's why the Republican establishment is another reason that they're very concerned, is that they don't think he can appeal to a lot of the groups, the independent voters you need to bring in to construct a coalition to win in November.
The next couple of primaries will show whether the Ted Cruz surge is real. And even if it is real, what does that mean by the time that Donald Trump and Ted Cruz and whoever else get to the convention? Dimitri Sevastopoulos, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
So back to the Republicans now. Retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson is out of that Republican presidential primary.
We still have millions of Americans who are saying on Facebook, you cannot leave us. We have to have a representative of honesty.
Well, leave them he did, Ben Carson. Or did he really? One way that Ben Carson's campaign stood out wasn't the fresh policy ideas or primary wins, certainly. Carson raised a lot of money from a lot of people, $54 million in total, more direct donations than any other Republican candidate, and mostly from small donors who had never given to any campaign before. Now, we've talked before on this show about how much modern campaigns know about their supporters and their voters. They want to be able to predict who's going to volunteer, who will vote, and also, of course, who will give them money. And that information isn't just valuable during a campaign. It turns out it has a price even after the campaign is over. Carrie Levine is money and politics reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, how are you?
It's great to have you. How is Ben Carson's donor list, this huge list, email list of donors that he's collected, how is it worth money now? Who wants it? How do they get it?
Well, now that Ben Carson is out of the campaign, this is a tangible asset that his campaign still has. These are people who came out to support him, who hundreds of thousands gave money to support him, and they respond to certain kind of fundraising solicitations. So that's going to be a value to other candidates and political action committees and groups raising money in the political arena.
Now, Ben Carson isn't alone. Lists like this are rented all the time. And if you're like me and you follow politics, you get solicitations in your email box all the time. But Ben Carson stands out because a lot of his list is first-time donors. So what does that mean? How does that make it more valuable?
Well, first of all, it's a big list. It's a national list. As you point out, it contains a pretty good percentage of people who probably aren't on other political lists. These are people who were really committed to Ben Carson, who responded to him personally. And so when other people rent that list, they're going to be thinking about how to approach those people, what these people respond to, and how they might raise money from them.
So if I'm that candidate and I'm sort of Carson-like in my politics, what's a Ben Carson donor worth? What am I paying to get a hold of his list for a week or for one email blast?
Well, you know, it's hard to say because they haven't started renting it yet, but I had some folks estimate for me what that list might be worth, and they were talking about $5 to $6 a name over a few years. So that obviously, when you've got hundreds of thousands of names on a list, adds up to quite a bit of money.
That money goes where? To Ben Carson himself or back into his campaign fund?
Back into his campaign committee. You know, there's a surprising number of campaign committees for people who aren't candidates anymore that are still alive, still running, and still renting out their lists.
So telemarketers buy and sell information to other marketers, credit card companies. We're used to having our consumer information shared around. Is this fundamentally different in politics, or is this what we should expect, do you think?
It runs along a very similar track. As for whether we expect it, you know, I think it depends on the person that you're talking about. There are certainly people like you and me who subscribe to a lot of email lists, who like to keep tabs on what's going on, and we're aware that those lists get traded in the marketplace. I think, though, that I talked to a large number of Ben Carson donors for this story and for another story I did last year, and many of them were responding to Ben Carson because they thought he was a different kind of candidate. And so when I made some calls for this story to talk to people about how they felt about this, whether this was what they expected, a lot of people were surprised.
Surprised that they would wind up on someone else's list? But it's just a bunch of emails in your inbox, right? In the end, is it really
Not
a compromise, do you think?
It's emails, it's phone calls, it's direct mail. There's lots of different ways to approach people. I think it's also a question of whether this is what people intended when they set out.
And whether they want to be contacted by further campaigns that are Carson-like. Correct. One of the other best examples of this probably was Sarah Palin, who had a huge list and has rented out her list quite a bit.
That's right. And I think it's also a good example of how over time these lists need to be kept fresh or they get a little less valuable. I think Sarah Palin's PAC is pulling in less money from that than it did a few years ago when that list was fresher.
So if it's $5 or $6 a head, do you think Ben Carson himself or somebody close to him has done the final assessment of what he might be able to pull in here?
I'm sure that he has estimates of that because there are people working for Ben Carson who are in this business.
Well, if you gave Ben Carson money during the campaign because you liked his politics, the campaign didn't succeed. But get ready. You may be getting those phone calls. You may be getting those emails or, dare I say, even a text or two from someone who considers themselves Carson-like. Carrie Levine, money and politics reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, maybe Ben Carson might be able to have some empathy for the Crawley family fading into obscurity. The PBS show Downton Abbey did come to an end last night. That show traced the fate of that Crawley family, beginning in 1912 with the sinking of the Titanic. And it ended with, well, I won't tell you how it ended. We don't do spoilers here on The Takeaway. But it is a sad day for many Downton fans, so we wanted to give you, The Takeaway listener, the chance to sit in the boardroom at PBS and give us your elevator pitch for the show's replacement. From Houston, Texas, a series about a French chateau in the Champagne region that struggles with recovery from the wine blight of the late 1800s, only to face World War I. And Wanda from Oakland, California, has this pitch, Uptown Oakland, The Rise of the Hipsters, The Fall of Diversity. I love it. Give us your program ideas, 8778, my take is our number. And if you want to check out John Hockenberry's hour-long conversation with Julian Fellows, creator of Downton Abbey, head to thetakeaway.org. It's right there in the Take Note section.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org.
It's The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today. We have a look now at life under the Islamic State, or Daesh, through the eyes of a person who's living there.
It's Friday. This is the day we used to gather in the street after prayers and have long chats. But not anymore. Anyone gathering in public without permission now risks being accused of plotting against Daesh.
International media is kept out of ISIS-controlled areas, of course, and that means that most of the coverage is from far away. Troop movements, battles, videos of atrocities that are posted on YouTube. But millions of regular people live in those towns and villages under ISIS control, and their lives continue pressed between the draconian Sharia law of a brutal terrorist regime and the destructive armies on the other side of wars in Syria and in Iraq. One way to bridge the gap between headlines and real life is simply to let those people speak for themselves, to tell their own story. That's the goal of a new series, Life Inside Islamic State Diaries. It's a first-person account of an activist living in Raqqa, Syria, the capital of the Islamic State. Mike Thompson is BBC Foreign Affairs correspondent and the creator of the series, and his story begins back in January of 2014 when ISIS first took control in Raqqa.
Well, it all started about, over a year ago, in fact. I've been getting interviews out of various parts of Syria to find out from people on the ground what's happening there. And, of course, one place where that has been hardest has been in Raqqa, because it is the capital of their so-called caliphate, and it's a place where they're extremely sensitive to criticism or anyone speaking to the Western media. And I began by speaking to a group called Raqqa Is Being Slaughtered Silently. But after a while, through them, I got put through to this other group called Al-Shakira 24, and trust built up. And then it was about 4 months ago now that I proposed to them that perhaps a better way of getting more detailed personal knowledge of what's happening on the ground in Raqqa is for one of them to write it, and with plenty of time. It would enable them, if it's part of a series, to say a lot more, and they could send text out, which in this case was encrypted and sent to a third country, which would lessen the risk of their voices identifying them. So it would also give us a fuller picture, too, of life there.
And that first-person account, I think, is so important to the impact of what you're doing here. Let's listen to another clip from the series. This is the first time, in fact, that ISIS rolled into Raqqa. Listen.
A few weeks later, I was working in the shop when I heard gunfire and the boom of heavy weapons outside. Everyone was running on the street. My friend gripped my arm and said, Daesh had taken over the city.
Got some sound production there, of course, but it's harrowing to hear it in the first-person voice of your subject.
It is very much so. It's one of those things when journalists like ourselves are reporting what's happening in places like Syria, so often we dwell on the military or the political, the wider overview. But it's when you look at what ISIS is doing to people on the ground, it gets you to realize the effect all this has. And we get an insight from talking to this guy in Raqqa of how the fear and brutality created by ISIS permeates virtually every area of life, and how it affects not just communities, but how it affects family life, how it affects individuals.
Then my mobile rang. It was my mother. She asked me to buy some groceries for the family, but I can't afford much these days. On the way back, I thought up lots of excuses to explain why I'd returned with so little food. But I didn't need to. Like most parents here, my mother was just delighted that I hadn't been arrested or killed and was safely home again.
And one of the biggest compliments that was paid to me about the series was one listener who said, it seems to eat up all that distance in geography, race, religion, anything else. This guy felt like he could be my brother. And that, of course, is always the aim, to try and really bring that across.
Well, you talk about that reality. For those of us who've spent a lot of time trying to follow the ISIS invasion and the rise of ISIS on television or on the radio, it doesn't quite come close in many instances, the horror, to the types of stories we're hearing here. I want to set up another clip that we chose, Mike Thompson, and then have you explain it.
A crowd had gathered around a deep hole. Crouched inside it was a woman. I asked people who she was and what she was doing there. Before I got an answer, a large masked man began reading. This woman was adulteress, and her punishment is to be stoned to death. His words were interrupted by the noise of warplanes overhead. A local vendor shouted, "Hide! Hide!" There were big explosions and body parts everywhere. Most of them belonged to civilians. It was a Russian airstrike, supposedly targeting terrorists. Isn't the terrorism we suffered on the ground enough? Now you bring it from the skies as well.
Mike Thompson, all I can say is that it's one horror replaced by another in that scene.
It certainly is. That was the scene depicting a woman who was in a hole in the ground and people were gathering around and about to stone her to death for adultery. And it seems sort of ironically that the airstrike seemed to have saved her from that at the time. Whether she survived after that is a different matter. But our diarist talks at one point about how he was told by a friend to take a different way home that night after working in his shop. And he said he didn't tell me why I should do that. And in the end, curiosity got the better of me and I went my normal route home and found this guy I knew whose head had been cut off and his body stuck in front of his parents' house. And there are also apparently severed heads placed on lampposts, fence posts around Raqqa sometimes, which are there obviously to dissuade anyone from in any way not cooperating with them.
Have you been able to get word back to your diarist that his story, their story, is getting out to the world now?
Yes, we have told them what is happening, although I haven't been able to speak to him for quite a few days now, which isn't unusual in that at various points in trying to get this diary series together, sometimes it could be a week or 10 days before we can make any contact at all with the group. And also we didn't want to send them, particularly the animated diaries that you've been playing clips of, because there's a lot of megabytes there, and of course were they caught in possession of these things, I dread to think what would happen. But we have told them the series is going ahead, and they are delighted that it is.
They should be delighted, and still, Mike Thompson, I have a feeling of dread as I leave you from this conversation that there's a chance your diarist may not survive. That's the case for everybody in Raqqa.
That is always a constant concern. And we went right through the scripts of the diaries, taking out anything he'd written, and there were quite a few things that we felt could lead to a sort of jigsaw identification of him or his family or those that are in his activist group. Because always it's the thought of, one, that he may just get caught anyway, but two, that we want to help get the word out about what is happening there, because it is so hard to do that and it's so valuable to do that. But at the same time, what we don't want is in any way to endanger his life any more than it's endangered already.
Mike Thompson is BBC Foreign Affairs correspondent. He's the creator of Life Inside Islamic State, diaries chronicling the daily life of an activist in Raqqa through radio broadcasts and animated features. Mike Thompson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll stay in Raqqa, Syria now, where Russian-backed Syrian government forces are bearing down on rebel forces there and on Islamic State fighters defending their capital. U.S.-backed forces are also closing in on a corridor between Raqqa and the Iraqi city of Mosul. Meanwhile, peace talks between the Syrian opposition and the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad are supposed to resume today in Geneva. A ceasefire is supposed to go into effect in the coming days, though not all parties in the war are part of that deal. Russia's priority here is to defeat rebels and strengthen Assad, not necessarily to defeat the Islamic State in Raqqa. With us is Rami Curry. He's founding director of the Issam Faris Institute at the American University in Beirut, and he says the U.S. is taking a back seat here.
The Russians have been pretty much calling the shots on the ground and in the air, and everybody is responding to whatever the Russians and the Syrians do with their two other important allies, the Iranians and Hezbollah. So basically, the Russians and the Syrian government are determining the flow of the fighting, and which will also have an impact on the diplomatic process. But the long-term end game is not clear to anybody. For instance, it's still not clear if the Russians are fully wedded to Assad having to stay in place. All we can say is right now the Russians are calling the shots, but in 2 months or 6 months, nobody knows.
That sounds like then the United States is left in a position of getting whatever collateral damage to ISIS that it can out of Russia and Assad's other priorities.
Well, the U.S. is very much responding to other people's initiatives on the ground, and this has been the case really since the beginning of the war, over 5 years ago now. The United States, by being reluctant to either fight on the ground seriously or give the mainstream opposition significant anti-aircraft weapons, the U.S. has basically relegated itself to being in the background and letting other people lead the process. And those other people now have become the Syrian government with Russia. Second, you've got ISIS. Third, you've got Al-Qaeda with the Jabhat al-Nusra. And fourth, you've got the Kurdish forces. Those four are the most powerful forces on the ground right now, and the United States is just responding in any way it can. And it really, frankly, the United States is somewhat of a secondary player right now. Their air power is still very significant. And when they use that air power in coordination, say, with the Kurdish fighters on the ground, that air power is significant. So the U.S. can play a role there. But other than that, the United States is pretty much following other people's leads.
So in the end, what does a Russian-backed Syrian government move on Raqqa mean for the viability of ISIS in Syria? Are they likely to survive this battle?
If there is a combination of significant international air power and ground forces fighting against it, that it would be defeated very easily. The Islamic State is not a very significant conventional military force. So if we're seeing now the combination of Syrian ground troops, Russian air power, and other ground forces attacking Islamic State, then Islamic State will definitely be defeated militarily and Raqqa will fall. And that is a significant blow to the Islamic State because Raqqa is first of all, it's their kind of symbolic heartland and capital. It's where they started, really. And it also is a critical link between their forces in around Aleppo, south around Palmyra, east Syria, Deir ez-Zor and Hasaka areas. And it's the critical link to the Mosul area. What would happen after that, nobody knows. I'm sure the Islamic State have plans for the day after. They're not going to just sit around and say, well, let's see what happens and watch it on TV. They're planning for some kind of insurgency, including attacks around the Arab world and internationally.
And of course, defeating ISIS in Raqqa comes at the price of a strengthened Bashar al-Assad, something the United States has said it doesn't want. Rami Khoury, founding director of the Islam Affairs Institute at the American University of Beirut. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Staples, with printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Wait till I tell my husband about this. So to my young friends out there, life can be great. But not when you can't see it. So open your eyes to life. And when it comes to drugs and alcohol, just say no.
Must be a big push this time, Ace.
The Admiral told me not to tell.
The Admiral should have told me not to worry.
I was the happiest girl in the world when I became we. I love that. I loved everything about marriage.
There are people who told me that it gets much easier. Well, maybe for them, but not for me. I miss him more now than I ever did.
Wouldn't it be nice if we could look at television or read the papers and read something wonderful and nice that's happened?
In her own words, throughout a very, very public life, an actress, a campaigner, first lady, Nancy Reagan, of course, will be remembered for all of this. And her 52-year marriage to President Ronald Reagan has often been described as the U.S. presidency's greatest love affair. In life, Nancy Reagan was a fierce defender and protector of her husband, both in the media and in public, and also behind the scenes in White House power struggles. President Obama said that she redefined the role of First Lady. Carlos Ferraza Anthony is a historian with the National First Ladies Library, and he's also a former speechwriter for Nancy Reagan, and he joins me now. Carl, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
And it's great to have you. Nancy Reagan's protectiveness, you know, for her husband, Ron, is famous. But what did that mean in their real life together? How did that manifest itself, do you think?
What a really great question. I'm so happy you asked that. Because by her own admission, that created a certain degree of stress for her. Everyone said it seemed like they were one and it seemed like they blended. But of course, in truth, they were two different people. You know, she knew in him that he had a real resistance, a fear of confrontation. And sometimes just working through a difficult conversation to come to a resolution, he would perceive as a confrontation. His inability to tell somebody who he really cared about as a person, but who might no longer be really doing the job that they needed to do, would have to go. And so it was so often left to Mrs. Reagan to take care of this. And I'm not sure that was a role that really came naturally to her, but it's one that she learned. And when you really look at her arc over those 8 years, you really see enormous personal growth in her as a human being.
During those times of White House power struggles, you mentioned there were struggles with the White House chief of staff at a time where Nancy Reagan really had to push her husband, the president, to make some moves that he didn't want to make. Was she a close reader of headlines? Was she sensitive to what was being said about her in the press and the impressions that were born of that, that she was manipulating the president or that she was somehow the power behind the, I'll call it the throne?
You know, she went through many different incarnations, which doesn't always happen. You know, sometimes people get cast with one persona and that is just so overwhelming that anything they do to contradict it just doesn't seem to get any attention. But her role really over time changed. And at the time of those confrontations, specifically the great big one, most important, with Chief of Staff Don Regan, occurred towards the end of the administration. 1987, the Tower Report was released with findings on the Iran-Contra scandal. It, to a certain degree, laid blame at the White House. And she felt that Don Regan really wasn't making a spirited defense of the White House and of the president. And yet he was persisting on an intensive schedule for the president, who had just gone through his third rather serious health crisis. You know, he had cancer twice and he had the assassination attempt. And she very much wanted to guard his schedule. And she really did guard the president's schedule. And she reviewed that to make sure it was not overloaded. At that point, it's almost like she didn't even care anymore what they said about her. The main thing was to ensure the reputation publicly and privately, the physical and emotional well-being of her husband.
Carl Sferrazza, Anthony, we're going to talk in a moment about Nancy Reagan's skills as a communicator and the drug war from the 1980s. But before we go, in our last few seconds here, your final thoughts.
I think there was a great complexity to her, and I think she was a very compassionate person. But I think she was under a lot of different pressure during those years. She lost her mother 2 days after she got out of the hospital from breast cancer surgery and didn't even have time to recover emotionally, as she said to me, from the surgery, but then the loss of her mother, and then the Gorbachevs came for the signing of the INF treaty. She went through a lot, and I think she came out well.
Carl Sferrazza, Anthony, National First Ladies Library historian and speechwriter for Nancy Reagan. Thank you so much for your thoughts.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today. And we pick up now on our conversation about the life and influence of Nancy Reagan on a subject that's probably the one the public remembers her best for.
Say yes to your life. And when it comes to drugs and alcohol, just say no.
I think you can see why Nancy has been such a positive influence on all that we're trying to do.
That's Nancy Reagan and, of course, President Ronald Reagan in a joint address on September 14th, 1986. The Just Say No campaign permeated popular culture at the time. How did the White House think it would reach young people then? Nancy Reagan breezed in for a turn with Gary Coleman on the three-camera sitcom Different Strokes. Listen.
I'm really here to see Arnold.
Who's talking about Mrs. Reagan?
Well, you know, I'm very concerned about drug abuse, especially among the young. And I was very impressed at the way that you spoke out.
Oh, it's nothing any other fearless journalist dedicated to the truth wouldn't do.
All right, so you got the laugh track there. That appearance stands up today as a famous bit of 1980s TV kitsch, but it's also a testament to what is now seen by many, in hindsight, as maybe the simplistic and naive message of the war on drugs. Just Say No. And we want to find out if the message worked at all. And if not, why not? What's the legacy of Nancy Reagan's key part in the war on drugs? Carl Hart is professor at Columbia University, author of High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery That Challenges Everything You Know About Drugs and Society. And he joins me. Carl Hart, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Todd.
As I said, Just Say No was often criticized for being simplistic and naive and ignoring real-world situations around drugs, especially with young people. Your thoughts?
Well, it was more than just being simplistic, because oftentimes people talk about the war on drugs and the Just Say No sort of mantra as being a failure, and when in fact it was actually kind of successful for a number of people. It failed the majority of the American taxpayers, but for a number of people, it's been successful. That's why it continues. And when I say it's been successful in helping to create this environment in which any drug use is seen as being pathological. And so that overly simplistic message, yeah, it certainly didn't do much for drug education, but it did a hell of a lot for people who are currently making a lot of money off of the war on drugs.
Another thing that it did, maybe that was positive, was it did identify drug initiation among the young as a critical issue. Even if the message itself didn't work, it got America focused on the importance of not starting in the first place, perhaps.
No, that's wrong.
Okay.
Drug initiation has always been a concern in the United States. I mean, long before Nancy Reagan, you go back to the early 1900s, people were concerned about that. And so I don't think so. I think that it did unequivocally for most Americans a horrible thing, because when we think about don't start in the first place, there will be people who start. The concern is how do we prevent abuse, and how do we educate people to not get in trouble with these sorts of things? The notion that people won't start, that's naive, and that is dangerous, actually.
So was the main problem here then that Just Say No crowded out other important forms of education that young people should have been getting at the time with that simplicity?
That's one of the main problems. But it also, I think in that speech that you played, you didn't play it all the way through. It was 1986 September when the president and Ms. Reagan faced the nation or talked to the nation about drugs. She was talking about us as a nation being intolerant of people who use drugs. And that is just simply inappropriate. And that's not what we want people to do. We don't want people to be intolerant of a number of things, and certainly not drug use. Not that we want people to engage in drug use, but we have to understand that people will engage in drug use. And the question becomes, how do we keep people safe when they do engage?
So what do you see then when you listen to Nancy Reagan as a communicator? That message was simplistic, but it did permeate. So evaluate her as a communicator, even if you think the message failed.
I think she was an outstanding communicator. I think her husband was an outstanding communicator. I think that many of the politicians today can take some lessons from Nancy and Ronald in terms of their communication skills. That's clear. I mean, as we think about that 1986, September 1986 speech that they gave to the nation, those two on the couch looking like the national parents, and also sounding like the national parents in terms of their persuasiveness and it being compelling. They were excellent. I don't think that's a question.
So the drug problem is still with us, of course. We all know that some attitudes have changed drastically, especially as it relates to marijuana. Redesign for a second an effective drug message. Let's imagine the president and Michelle Obama on, I don't know, Big Bang Theory, maybe a popular show today, going on to talk to the nation about drugs. What should it sound like?
Well, first of all, I don't accept the notion that the drug problem is still with us today. That's one of the problems, is people think of the drug problem as being about drugs. And I think it's a misunderstanding, and it's a misplacement of where our focus should be. Too often the focus is on the drugs themselves. When you think about the facts are this: the vast majority of people who use any of these drugs that we're talking about don't have a problem. That tells you that the problem is not the drugs. The problem lies elsewhere. So when you think about what Mr. Obama and what Ms. Obama should say to the nation, they should think about those other factors like, are people employed? Are we taking care of other co-occurring psychiatric illnesses that may be playing a role in people's abuse of drugs? Do people have opportunities? Do people have the skills to temper their behavior in any domain, not only with drugs, but any other domain? So there are a variety of things I like the current president to say and do, but the focus will not be on drugs.
Final thoughts before we let you go, Carl. You know, should Nancy Reagan or the White House of the 1980s, should they have seen this, or was it a necessary episode to go through to maybe reach a different understanding, hopefully, that we're reaching today?
This is really clear. When we think about the negative consequence that occurred as a result of this simplistic message, it has primarily decimated communities of color. And so if those same sorts of negative effects were happening in communities in which, in white communities in this country, I assure you, this thing would not be so prevalent today. This message, this outdated message, this misinformed message, this message that has done so much harm, I assure you. So when you say, should they have known, they would have known if the consequences were with the constituents that that they cared about.
A look back at the legacy of Nancy Reagan as communicator in the War on Drugs, the Just Say No campaign, perhaps big opportunities missed and problems ignored. Carl Hart, professor at Columbia University. He's author of High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery that challenges everything you know about drugs and society. Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today. The inventor of modern email, Ray Tomlinson, died on Sunday at age 74. It was his invention in 1971 that allowed computer users to send messages to a specific address, choosing the now ubiquitous at symbol. His coworkers said that though he sent the first email ever, Tomlinson did not check his own email very frequently. And neither do I. I'm a guy that never reached inbox zero. You're listening to an email user with, what is it, 112,000 unread messages. I'm sorry, Dr. Tomlinson. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and from Staples, with printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.